Sex Bob-omb, and we're here to make you think about death and get sad and stuff.
I'm hearing voices, animal voices, the tremor of cold, the feminine atmosphere, reaching my threshold, staring at the truth till I'm blind.
Okay, everybody in Afterout Land, today we have a guest with us, Andrew P. Weston, author of a variety of stuff, and here's Andrew. How's it going, Andrew?
Not too bad, thank you very much. Sunny, as always, here, sadly. I say sadly because, like, after a while, the heat gets a little bit oppressive. And, there you go. I do what I can to stay out the sun.
Such a difficult life.
I know, it's terrible.
As opposed to the rain that we're getting here and the tornadoes going down in the mid-US, etc.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit yourself stuff. I've been reading on your blog and on your Amazon page that you're a member of the British Sci-Fi Association, that you're currently living in a lovely little area of the world in Greece.
Yeah. It's at the island of Kos in the Dodecanese. It's not far from, about 5 miles off the coast of northern Turkey, southern Turkey. And it's always hot here, except for the winter. People are surprised how cold it can get here in the winter. And, we have olive groves next to the house. I'm overlooking a mountain and a valley. It's very nice. Very
nice.
Pleasant.
Awesome. And by cold in the winter, what do you mean? Like 17 degrees Celsius?
Oh, I know, it's terrible. No, it can get sub-zero temperatures, believe it or not. You actually have to have central heating. We were surprised just how cold it can get in the winter, and very wet. You know, the majority of the rainfall falls in 2 or 3 months. It's a joy.
Well, okay, I'm sure that helps with the keeping down on the snow plowing equipment and stuff.
Yep. Now and again, we did have a touch of the white stuff last winter. You know, it was just, everyone was out playing in it. It was woohoo. You know.
But did it paralyze the country?
No. This isn't Britain. You know, that leaves do that, and a smattering of leaves on rail tracks, and the odd touch of snow, and everything grinds to a halt. Here, it's something different. Normally, coffee. You know, everyone just stops for coffee. It doesn't even try in the first place. It's incredible.
Nice. So I'm reading some stuff here about you because that's what I do when I'm talking. I tend to multitask a lot. I didn't know about those books there. I only knew about the nine, or do you pronounce it the X?
The ninth. The ninth is, the Roman numerals. It was the not based on the lost ninth legion of Rome. But yes, that's the ninth, and a few of the works I've done for Percy Press. But I cut my teeth at another small publishers, and who helped me to develop quite a lot. Pagan Writers Press, it was called. It was originally another press, Ruby Lion Press, but unfortunately, just before publication of my first works with them, they were a victim of their own success and collapsed from the stress of things. So fortunately, Pagan Writers Press were aware of my work, and they jumped in and snapped up a few of the serials that I and the pitches that I put forward for work, and then from them here I am now.
Well, there you go. Fortunately, it does happen in the small press market where they come and go a lot, and it's sometimes hard to find good ones, but there's a lot of them out there.
Yes. I was very pleased to secure a contract with them because I was determined not to go along the self-publishing route. Not that you take it away from people who do that, but I thought, if you can get someone else to believe in your work, then it just adds a little bit of credibility to it. And they got me, as I say, they got me doing some things that I wouldn't have otherwise done, and which certainly improved my skill set as a developing author. So, I'm very, very thankful to them for helping me arrive at where I am now.
Exactly. I mean, publishers, that's one. I read a lot about how people are perceiving what should be the right way and the wrong way to go and get published, and it really makes it no difference. It's dependent on what the individual wants to achieve with their written work, right?
Yeah, very true. Yeah.
Because, I mean, self-publishing is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, there's a lot of bad writing out there, but it's not a bad thing.
Mm.
And then getting published with a small press publisher or even a large press publisher, if one's lucky enough to do so, is at another level that goes a different way.
Yes, it certainly does. It certainly does.
And I'm curious, when I talk to anybody about their experiences with dealing the different levels of stuff, because, I mean, I like to know about all sorts of stuff because I'm crazy that way.
Yeah.
But it also says you do poetry here, too, and... Oh. I didn't see anything listed as specifically as a poetry book or as some entries or whatever, but I was curious.
Yeah, I've done things through the Screech Owl. I've had quite a lot published through them. They're a British-based publishing house, you know, who've also put things into print with, what do you call them now? It's cool. I've forgotten the names of them. Muse Pie Press. A very select and very well established press. Penny Antifeud, their poetry is dark, it's more on the macabre side. But
that fits well with me.
Yeah, I mean, that is very good. Their themes have a lot to do with death and the darker side of things. So, you know, it helps you, delve into that. Tar River Poetry, things like that. I've had quite a few from different places, different publishing houses around the world with that. It's just something I dabble in. Different styles for different moods and so on. Out of them, I must admit, I do enjoy the Muse Pie Press. They call it the Shot Glass Journal. There's two styles of poetry they accept. The Shot Glass Journal, which is the shorter poetry, because when you try and tell a story in, you know, a few short sentences, that's why they call it the Shot Glass Journal. You can enjoy it over a short drink, as it were.
Yeah.
That's interesting. But the one that I really enjoy is the Fibonacci, the Fib Review. I don't know whether you've ever heard of it.
I've heard part of that, but not that specific.
It's like that Fibonacci sequence, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, where you add the preceding number onto the current line, as it were. So your poems, when you tell the story, have to be constructed along that sequence. The first line is one word, then one, then two words, then three, then five, then eight. And it really, really affects the way you write. You know, yeah. So, yeah, it keeps you on your toes.
What we call math, right?
Yes. It's just another form of expression that I enjoy. But I haven't published a book as such or my own work, but I've been published a lot I think it's about half a dozen other publications. You know, it's come out in print. So, but obviously now, because I'm so busy with the writing, it's something I haven't done for a few months. I've got poems there ready for submission, but I've been compiling quite a few that's combined with some of the current work I'm actually writing.
Cool. And I'm just looking at the cover for the ninth again, and I just noticed the thing embedded in the eye.
Oh, for the ninth. Yes, there are quite a few facets to that because of what the story involves. The concept of it was I came up with the ninth, as people are probably aware now, following a chat with some ex-colleagues in the Marines regarding what happened to that lost 9th Legion of Rome. I mean, it's the subject of quite a few films now, or two Hollywood blockbusters, was it? The Centurion and the Eagle, I think. And, when you look into it, although I'm not a history buff as such, military history is another thing. We were required to study that, when we were going through training and so on. A legion was a huge entity, absolutely huge, roughly 5,000 men and all sorts of different departments within it, not just your fighters, you had the builders and everything that went with it. And for them to just simply disappear, even now it remains a mystery. They're not sure exactly what date they disappeared and exactly where in Caledonia it was that they disappeared. But it was you know, fascinating to start researching into that, get the idea of, you know, what could have happened to them. And then a few months later, following the discussion, I just happened to watch that old, it's not so much a classic, but, you know, I enjoyed it, Millennium.
Yeah, great TV series.
It was the film Millennium. Where
oh, okay, the one with the plane.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah. Time travelers from the future, they come in, they snatch doomed passengers off, you know, in this case it was aircraft, and, you know, they take them away to populate a future world, as it were, that, you know, there'd been a calamity and, you know, they needed bodies, as it were, to repopulate the Earth. And I thought, oh, you know. And of course, that conversation was still in my mind about the ninth. I thought, you know, obviously being a sci-fi buff, I thought, what happens if we take it a stage further, you know, and take them elsewhere, make it a little bit, you know, Forbidden Planet-ish, if you like, you know, somewhere else there's been a calamity, they need people to help them fight a, you know, a losing battle. And yeah, it just developed from there. And it was so that's why there's various elements within that you see from the picture. You probably see there's a DNA strand in the background because it involves an amalgamation, if you like, or a splicing of DNA. There are all sorts of elements in the picture that we combined in that tells a mini story in itself.
But okay. I was going to throw in that, like, you keep throwing out references to some old sci-fi stuff. It's like, oh, cool, I like all that stuff. But yeah. Would you call this book more for the literate, the more involved, who understand a little bit more about history and stuff, or more along the lines of, this is a good ride, story, journey, hey, things happen, but I'm not going to really explain the history behind them? Because the reason why I was mentioning the bit about the eyes, the SPQR reference...
Yeah, well, it's really a combination of both. You know, that was, if you like, the seeds of the story. That's where I got the concept, the idea from. You know, you take people away from their natural environment, with the added twist, of course, they were snatched away from Earth along with their enemies. And it transpires that, you know, from whatever time period, and that happens as, you know, the concept of the story was, you know, it's not only the Ninth Legion of Rome who was snatched away fighting the, you know, the Highland tribes in Caledonia, but it's a U.S. cavalry unit and the people they're fighting at the time, an amalgamation of some of the Central Plains Native American tribes, a near-future Special Forces unit and the eco-terrorists they're battling, you know, the conference. When you're in a, shall we say, a confrontational situation, you sometimes think, right, we've got to get the job done, we've got to do this, we've got to do that. And all of a sudden, when your circumstances change, you find, oh, you know, the enemy of my enemy might be my friend. Or you know, a twist on that, when they're snatched away and put in a situation whereby they're thinking, ah, you know, fight or die. You either fight to stay alive, you know, get past your differences with these people who were your former memories, or you will die. Simple as that. And it was just based on that, a simple concept. And, you know, I allowed it to develop. And, yeah, it grew to what it became. I think it's a straightforward sci-fi thing. Yes, there's a historical element to it. Because I think nowadays when you write science fiction or even fantasy, if you can base it in an element of truth, which is what this precept is, base it in truth, then people have got that anchor to reality, if you like. They can, oh, yes, you know, this is based on an actual real life, you know, actual legion. They existed. You know, they're part of history. Even with the cavalry unit, it was fictional, but I based it at a time in American history coming up to the election of Abraham Lincoln as president. With the you know, the fermenting troubles at the time between the North and the South divide, the Confederacy, the Union, and so on. So I added that element in. And when people have got these little anchors, if you like, to reality, it makes the fiction side of it that more plausible.
And were you playing Mortal Kombat in the background when you came up with the idea?
No. It's just my warped and fragile mind.
Oh, okay.
And I'm like this all the time. I've always. I was one of these strange people. Thanks to my parents, I could read before I went to school. And being a child of the 1960s, you know, with the space race on, science fiction was, you know, blooming and so on. I've always thought that way. When I go to sleep at night, I'm always thinking of plots and stories and this scenario, that scenario. It's the way I drift off to sleep. And some of the dreams, whoa, you know.
So process-wise, this was like your first novel, or this is the first big novel?
This is the first big novel. The other one, for example, as you can see when you've looked into my publishing history, like my first series really was the Guardian series. And that Guardian series, again, it's a product of my life. I served in the military for 9 years in a specialized role. Following that, I came out and I was in the police for nearly 30 years. You know, I'm older than Hassan. It's terrible. Hello, Shelley.
As long as you don't start saying, get off my lawn, you whippersnipper.
Yeah.
Then you're okay.
No, but, and of course, working all my life in that environment, you often dealt with things where you think, oh, goodness sake, you know, if only we could have got here soon, if only we could have dealt with that in a more proactive way instead of responding to this type of disaster scenario. What, you know, if only we could anticipate it. And and basically it was a mashup of Thunderbirds, because I grew up Thunderbirds, of course.
Thunderbirds are go.
Yeah, with X-Men, if you like. What happens if there was an entity that was watching from behind the scenes that had the ability not only to respond much more quickly to disasters, wherever they're called around the world, but could actually, in some cases, anticipate it. You know, because indeed, that's the way police forces around the world now, but through a gathering of intelligence, they like to be proactive as opposed to reactive. And it was just that, you know, that was developed over many years, and that was the concept that I introduced the Guardians through. And from them, you know, various other things, as I say, through that first problem, they encouraged me to branch out. And but the ninth is the first real epic. You know, I've taken all the things I've learned. So I sat down and I thought, right, now, you know, I've been in this learning phase now for 2 or 3 years. Let's really sit down, take my time and do something that's going to make an impact. And, you know, poof, it is. I mean, 6 months in, it's still, you know, charting everywhere around the world and other things that are in development. You know, so yes, very nice.
So then that would lead very clearly to the pantser or plotter. Do you like take a long time to plot out how you want the story to develop, or do you just start writing and go?
I am a great planner before I start to work. Talking to the ninth, I did a lot of research because obviously if you're going to base the entire concept of a story around, you know, a historical entity like the Ninth Legion, you've got to know what you're talking about. And it's a great eye-opener. I did about 4 or 3 months research altogether, not just obviously into the Ninth Legion, but into US cavalry units, into I was helped a great deal with the Plain Indian tribes and so on, because we have a friend who's of Cree descent. That was very, very good. But doing a lot of, you know, you put a lot together, a lot of planning, and then I write what I call out my skeleton, if you like. I want to bring this concept to life. So I create a skeleton, and the skeleton obviously has a beginning, it has an end, it has, if you like, there's points along the body where, you know, you have to anchor certain important plot points and so on. But once I start writing, I must admit, certain facets have turned out differently, because once it starts writing, it takes on a life and an energy of its own. And, you know, so although I do a lot of planning beforehand, once I start writing, I let it rain free, as it were. If you understand, because sometimes it's led me along directions that, you know, I wouldn't originally have thought of, and it works quite well.
Yeah, the organic development, breathing, yeah. Living. Hey, it's yes. Going to go take its own life sometimes and go different ways.
Oh yeah, I'm a bit of a a contradiction, I suppose, a juxtapose, if you like. All that planning. And then I just let it free reign, because sometimes, as you know, a story can take on a life of its own. You think, well, I'm going to go with this. And yeah. And then you adapt, you make little changes along the way, and it really, really works well. Very pleasing.
Cool. So I'm assuming that you've got some influences being a, much like myself, from the 60s as well.
Oh, yeah.
Reading a lot of old classic science fiction movies, stuff like that. What are some of the things that you would call influences in that regard?
Oh, from the early time, Ray Bradbury, I mean, the first one that really, really hit me, I think, oh, goodness me, going back now. Ray Bradbury, I think it was what do you call it? A Fall of Moondust.
Cool.
A Fall of Moondust. It was a short story. You know, now the reason I remember it is because it's like off one of my favourite vampire, Celine. That was it. Yeah, on the, there's like a star cruiser Celine, you know, travelling along this sea of dust, if you like, and it develops mechanical problems and sinks into the earth, and you know they have to get to them and rescue them in time. I always remember that one. That had a huge influence on me. I, Robot, if you remember. That was a, but I read Clark, Heinlein, Asimov. I was an avid reader. I read nearly a book a day. On top of my study. I'm one of these. I learned to read early. I'm more switched on. I look like a thug, but I'm not. and yes, they couldn't believe the speed I used to read. I used to read 6 or 7 books a week of all the old sci-fi classics. Because in those days, of course, the 1960s, there wasn't all that much fantasy about. It was science fiction.
Yeah, I mean, real fantasy at the time was like Tolkien. And then one or two people said, hey, we can be like that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, then you got the likes of, when you go into fantasy, like Stephen Donaldson, you know, which is absolutely superb. But sorry, getting back to your science fiction.
Well, fantasy's good too, because Donaldson's White Gold Wielder was an awesome series.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I stumbled into him quite by chance. I was in the military at the time, and it was on my first deployment across the water to, we had a thing in those days where you had to do regular deployments across the water from Britain to Northern Ireland. And a friend of mine had, a book on his bedside cabinet, and I looked at it, and it was Lord Fowl's Bane, the first book of that. And what attracted me to it, because I like to draw as well, I'm not much of a painter, but I do like to sketch, real life, still life fantasy and things like that. So I'm quite good at replicating an actual scene, as long as it's not a face. Can't do faces for some reason, I don't know why. But I saw, and of course, that original, especially in Britain, because obviously I learned now that different countries around the world, they have different covers, for the big authors.
Yep.
And that picture, we had, thinking back now, it was a main cover, if you like, which is quite a bland background, but there was a central circle, an ocular, if you like, and in that you had the finger of Kevin's watch sticking up into the air with lightning coming down and striking the pinnacle. And I thought, ooh, I'd like to draw that. And I looked at the book, hello, look, what's this? And I asked to borrow it. And as soon as I started reading, I just loved his method of reading. And I know he aggravates some people, Stephen Donner, because talk about long, slow build-up. It's like versus the entire book. Oh, he's a swine. You could strangle him. But, oh, what an excellent storyteller. And when I started to branch into fantasy, he was the first real fantasy writer that, attracted me to that genre. And, and well done, because that was a superb series, as you say. What a fantastic concept.
I would totally agree with you, because that's probably one of the earliest fantasy books I was into as well. I would say that between the 60s to the 80s is probably when a lot of the, hey, let's really experiment with this crap and like go in left field, right field, and center field, and all other fields with stuff. And it was like there was a wide variety of stuff.
Yeah.
So obvious.
Go on.
No, keep going. I was just going to go in a minor segue.
And that's what I'm very careful about as well, because I have always, I've always thought, I like to read quality work, and with that, I felt. Probably the same as yourself, there was that sudden explosion of fantasy writing and indeed science fiction writing at the time. It seemed to, as it were, impel the science fiction side of things along as well. But a lot of rubbish came out, I felt. because I was an avid reader, and you know, you start getting into it, and I do have a wide taste. I mean, I can say to you know, different writers do have different styles. They've got that different flavour to the writing, and you can either relate to it instantly. Some are acquired learning. For example, two ends of the spectrum. You've got Stephen Donaldson, if you like, who has a very distinctive style of writing that's like on a slow pressure cooker. Tad Williams, I enjoy his work, but he's got a very different style of writing, and he took a little bit of getting used to, I must admit. One of my favourite writers, a very helpful guy, Raymond Feast, again, a different
awesome style. Writer.
Yeah, what a concept over all those years. But you know, these different styles and so on. But there was a lot of rubbish out there as well. And in amongst it, of course, you nearly lost some absolute gems. You know, Pratchett, when he came out. You know, wonderful guy. Totally different way of doing things. You know, he was out there. Fantastic. I'll take what he was taking. You know, he was superb. Absolutely superb. Terry Brooks, for example. Yep. You know, the people either love him or hate him. But, you know, and yes, he did suffer, I think, the influence of the big houses that sometimes happens.
Well, back in that time, you're talking about a stranglehold structured environment, not available with technology like we can do today, where it's like, hey, instantaneously you can get answers, relatively.
Yeah, and so I enjoyed his work. But, and then through that, believe it or not, I'd heard of Tolkien, but I didn't read Tolkien until... hang on, scratch his head, look. Yeah, 1980, and oh, that was fantastic. And of course, that led to the Silmarillion as well, which I think is absolutely superb. I love the Silmarillion.
And unfortunately, we will not be seeing any new Tolkien-based movies.
Ah, that's a shame, because the Silmarillion would be awesome.
And you can blame Hollywood for that.
Mm.
Because the estate has said, when are we getting paid?
Ah.
And Hollywood saying, we didn't make any money. And everybody looks at them and say, what do you mean you didn't make any money?
Oh.
That's Hollywood. Hollywood is a messed up environment.
Yeah, I'm crushed now.
But, I mean, who knows? Maybe they'll do something later eventually, work all that crap out, and it's good. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, a lot of people don't realize that Tolkien has like about 17 books or whatever in that whole thing. It's forward, backwards, Middle Earth War, the whole thing, well before Sauron even showed up and well after Sauron's even left the playing field.
I mean, The Hobbit as well. You know, I was quite surprised because I'm glad it grew up in a way, because if you remember, like The Hobbit, if I remember correctly, was written for his grandchildren or something like that. Yeah. And the styling of it, the elves were like, eh?
Yeah.
You know, they're like this noncy, flouncy kind of, you want to slap them. But fortunately, for the films, he allowed them to grow up.
Well, yeah.
That's a shame that we won't see the Silmarillion then, because that would have explained a lot. But there you go.
Yeah. It's the cycles, the way it goes on. I'm sure in 10 years somebody will redo Lord of the Rings again. It's like, what? No, that's one of those that you shouldn't really necessarily have to redo again.
Yeah. Well, sometimes you just can't explain the understanding of, you know, entities like Hollywood or some of the you know, the science fiction or fantasy channels. It's funny, we get a lot of American TV over here in Greece through satellite, and you think surefire hits that, you know, would deserve a follow-on, and they don't do second series of them. Or I think you're like, what? You know, what are you thinking? For goodness sake.
Like
know?
What? I'm curious how a lot of Hollywood stuff gets out in different parts of the world.
Growing up, as I say, I enjoyed quality sci-fi and fantasy. And do you remember that first series of Battlestar Galactica? Remember you know, the very...
Very much so.
Yes, and it was kind of like, okay-ish at the time, but the second series, I absolutely adored it. You know,
the one that came out a little while ago, or Galactica 1980?
Oh, no, not the first one, the second series.
Okay.
The more mature one.
The gritty one.
Yeah, that was absolutely awesome.
Now, and here's a quick question for you about that. Being from a military perspective, did you feel that actually felt true to a military-style environment? Because I did.
Yes, that's why I could relate to it, because... Unlike, shall we say, your Star Wars element, where everything's lovely, shiny, and bright, and you've got these super futuristic guns that can never seem to hit anything. It's, you know, wonderful, you know, stand right in front of a stormtrooper. Look, you can't hit me. whereas that thing, you know, they were dirty, they were banged up, and it was filthy, it was grimy, and you know, and it doesn't matter, because sometimes, especially in a battle environment, you do, you have your chain of command, but unless you're switched on and know what you're talking about and you can inspire others, you do get, you know, so we say those are the lower ranks who will try and get in your face. So, yes, I did enjoy it. I really, really did enjoy that. And I felt it was quite realistic in quite a, you know, in quite a few of its scenarios. I loved it. It was awesome.
Okay, we can see eye to eye on that, because I agree 100% as well. The ending was a little, well, that's a little wishy-washy, but okay.
Yeah, but look what happened with it. I mean, that was a surefire hit. It's got a massive, massive following. And it generated a number of spin-offs. Now, I think, was it the Caprica series?
Yes.
I had to wait for that to come out, because they didn't actually show that here. But I got the DVD series. I thought, yeah, see where the, you know, as they turn the skin jobs came from, that could have developed well, and how it, you know, evolved into the, you know, the silent hatred that we came to know in Battlestar Galactica. But they cancelled that. Blood and Chrome. Now, I thought that was quite a good, looking at the young Adama. And I thought, cool, that had some potential as well. And yet, evidently, that was put forward as, you know, a basis for perhaps another mini-series. I don't know, they cancelled it. And you think, goodness me, what's another one? I quite enjoyed Alphas. Oh, no, that went into Series 2. Again, a clever spin on things. Oh, The Tomorrow People. There you go. Did you ever see that?
Yes, I did.
I remember the original, you see, because that was an original British thing from the 1970s.
That's the one that I remember as well.
And you know, that one, yes, in comparison, it was a little bit camp in certain things, you know, but it was a time from the 70s, if you like. It was, and obviously the difference in special effects. But, you know, the preset, they took it, they changed it, if you like, and obviously put it in New York, wasn't it? This latest one. And I thought, yeah, it was quite good. And evidently, there's not a second series coming from it. And you think, these have got, like, they generate huge followings, and it's kind of like, I don't want that. It's not in current favour. And they take surefire hits, and they just ignore it. Well, you know, it's like, I thought the entire concept of producing a show like that is to get the followers, to generate revenue, to, you know, like, do some more, and yet, oh, no, doesn't matter, you've got millions of followers.
Well, exactly. Yeah. There's two cases in point right now. What happened is Hannibal is a very popular U.S. show, and
yes,
their fourth season, they've canceled it. And it's like, why? It's everybody loves that show sort of thing. And then Constantine, which only got the one season, awesomely, bloody brilliant show, because it takes a methodology of storytelling that's really different for an American audience and gives it that dark and gritty side to the magic realism stuff. It's like, and then they cancel it after one season.
Yeah, it's just strange, isn't it?
Yeah.
There you go.
We'll just say there's no accounting for some. It's like the math in Hollywood is completely, wait, 1 plus 1 usually equals 2, but to the Hollywood world, it's like maybe equals like a half.
Yeah,
it's a weird thing.
Yeah. There's a lot to be said for faulty controlled substances, I suppose.
True. But that all being that, seeing as how we also touched on fantasy, we've got the Doctors in Hell series that you're getting into. And I understand you've got something else going on there as well, which I know Janet Morris has mentioned briefly somewhere.
Yes, it's a great privilege, really, being drawn into the Persid fold, as it were. It's funny, I was working on a little bit of that before we started speaking. She enjoyed my work, especially through the ninth, and so I was invited to contribute. And it's funny, Doctors in Hell that's come out, the latest in the Heroes in Hell universe, you're introduced to a character, Damon Grimm, and Grimm is basically the Reaper, if you like. He's a personified actual Reaper, Satan's chief bounty hunter, and is the go-to guy. You know, any problems, which of course there are in a place like Hell, where everyone's, you know, the entire all the levels of Hell, they're prime sport, if you like. The main pastime is murder and, you know, backstabbing and so on. And so he's a very busy guy, and you're introduced to him in the context, as it were, of Doctors in Hell. Where he's tracking down a renegade from Injustice. But from that, what I thought would be a good idea to do, because I liked his character so much, I discussed it with Janet, you know, would you mind? having seen what my work is like now, if I devised a series of novels set in that same universe. They're, if you like, separate from, but also involved with the heroes in Hell Universe. He was intrigued by the concept. So what I came up with was you're introduced to Grimm in Doctors in Hell, and then the first Hell novel, if you like, involving Grimm called Hellbound, which is out later this year from Percy Press, listeners. It follows on almost directly from that story in Doctors in Hell. And you find out he finishes... or completes that particular mission that involves the recovery of a renegade doctor. And then it follows on into other things that are happening in the many levels of the underworld. Lots of intrigue, lots of twists, lots of action, dark humour. And then that leads into a subsequent Heroes in Hell anthology, which will then leapfrog into another novel and so on. So we've managed to, as it were, to incorporate it very, very nicely into that entire universe, and obviously it keeps me on my toes. But yes, it's good fun.
Well, I mean, I'm also in the Doctors in Hell book as well as a couple of the other ones there. And do you like my thing about the Heroes in Hell series has been the landscape that you can write on is so huge and so vast and so many different possible variables that you can work with. That's the coolest thing in the world to work in.
Yes, it is. But also, in certain sense, it can be restrictive in this, because remember, this the ninth, for example, with the ninth, I can do what I want, where I want, when I want. But of course, coming in, being invited into this such a well-established universe, remember, the Heroes in Hell universe is a real universe. It's a living entity. It's been around for quite a while. And it has its rules, doesn't it? You know, it's
got absolutely. This
what you can, what you can't do. Things that you can stretch, there are things that you definitely can't do. So, of course, for me, it's still, and I'm still learning about it. It's been a steep learning curve, exactly what I can and can't do and how certain characters can develop. And if you want to refer, to other characters, you know, other stalwarts, if you like, from the Heroes in Hell universe, what you can and can't do with them. So, yeah, it's good. As I say, it keeps you on your toes. It's interesting. And, yes, I'm looking forward to develop this as much as I can. People should get to love Damon Grimm. He's quite a so-and-so.
Well, Doctors in Hell is the 18th, officially, the 18th book in the Heroes in Hell series. And originally, it started in 1986 with the original story, Heroes in Hell, which was just an anthology shared world universe, one of the earliest shared world universes segueing off after Thieves' World. Were those books that you read as well? Because that was stuff that I grew up on.
Because since I've become, I still work at the moment, I'm fortunately just getting to the stage where soon I'll be able to write full time.
Cool.
But because of that, my time is extremely limited. So when you spend, for example, at the moment this week, I'm on night shifts. It's hellish. I came back home this morning. I was here just after 8 o'clock. After finishing at 8, I go to bed. I get up for 4 or 5 hours. Go back to bed. Get up again for work. It eats into your time a lot. So I have to be very disciplined for the time I have to like get my writing done, because I've obligated myself to get X amount of works done in X amount of time, as it were. So I don't get a lot of time for reading. I've read some of the Heroes in Hell novels because obviously I needed. I think going back about I've read Poets in Hell, Lawyers in Hell. I've read Bridge Over Hell, which was a separate novel again, and one more, I can't remember.
Dreamers or Rogues?
Rogues.
Okay.
I've read those. They are on my list to do, if you like, but I have to be careful about how much time I spend reading when I have to ensure that I fulfill my obligations and get some quality work out there for Percy Press.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it is, when we're younger, we don't have as many obligations. Yeah. When we're older, we got to do stuff, so let's do stuff.
Oh, I miss those days where I could read a book a day and had nothing else to do. Cool. Especially during the school summer holidays, it was wonderful. But now I don't get that. But soon I will do, and I'll be able to, allocate my time in a much more relaxing way, an enjoyable way too.
Set your own schedule, as it were, and do the what and the what.
Depending on what the wife says, of course.
Yes, I noticed that holding your breath and being told what to do by the wife.
Yes, that's it. That's one of my challenges.
Yes, so, I also see that you've got comments mentioning about NASA and Amazing Stories and Astronaut.com. What's that about?
Well, I say because I did a lot of reading before I went to school, one of the first books I had was a book on astronomy. And again, I suppose it blends in with the environment I grew up with. You think of those TV shows from the 1960s, you know, Lost in Space, Space Patrol, Fireball, so, you know, they're very space science fiction oriented. So I think it was natural that I had a love of the stars. Couldn't see a lot, of course, because I grew up in Birmingham, which is the second city in the UK. And it is quite a vast and sprawling entity, which, and the light pollution is disgusting. But nevertheless, I did have a huge interest in astronomy, which led on into school and college. I seem to have a natural bent towards the sciences and so on. I'm an astronomer with a master's degree in astronomy. And, of course, you know, it comes from that because of my...
Hold on a second. You said Birmingham, right?
Yeah.
That's where my favorite band, Black Sabbath, comes from.
Ah, Black Sabbath, yes. I'll tell you what, some of the bands from Birmingham, I've met a number of them, not from Black Sabbath, but, you know, different bands from there. They're quite down to earth, and they, you know, they have pubs, as we call it, in Britain. And, you know, especially in the early days, you would get, like Slade. I followed Slade growing up. I don't know whether you've ever heard of
Slade. I do. I love them.
And I know some of them.
Oh, cool.
They're not like close friends. I'm just like other people who happen to be in the area at the time. And you met Slade. Noddy Holder, what a guy. You know, I've met him several times and absolutely superb. You know, very down to earth. And that voice, it's real. You know. Good grief, you know, absolutely superb. Yeah, I've met him a few times, and one or two other groups in the Birmingham area too. Yeah, but it's
cool. Sorry, I did a segue there from you. Go back to the whole astronomy thing.
Oh, yeah, and of course from that, it just led into, like with NASA, we do this thing, like there's obviously an asteroid watch, which is a new... a new program that you can do. Obviously, it's from distance learning. You can log into the NASA sites and do stuff like that. And of course, the other one is like it's searching for certain particles, if you like, within gel, interstellar particles. It just helps with the origin. Sorry, I'm just trying to keep it simple without going off. The first thing I started doing for NASA was you're looking for interstellar particles on the Stardust project. And what they do, they get samples of aerogel. And what you do, you study them looking for signs that interstellar particles have actually passed through it. They make a distinctive signature, if you like, through this gel. So that's how I started doing work for them. Hopefully it's branching out now into they've got this new project coming out, as I say, for the asteroid watch, but you need particular algorithms for that, which I'm still trying to install onto my computer because the speed isn't very good. It's awesome work to do. You know, you can log into the site, you can do it from a distance.
And well, especially with that little satellite, whatever the hell it is right now, on the comet. Is it the comet that they're getting the information back from right now?
There are a number.
Yeah.
there's a number going on at the moment because they've got the Mars project evolving. They've got Ceres out there at the moment. They're evolving. There's quite a lot to do. And because you must forgive me, unless it's something I'm directly involved in, I say I don't sadly have time to branch off and like I used to and delve into them.
There's a lot going on. It's like from what I can see, you're talking about it's the thousand eyes on one project. And everybody's like adding their one little bit. It's like, well, it may not individually be, hey, it's all that interesting, but collectively, it can prove to be something very impressive.
Yeah. I mean, and this stems over into the astronaut.com because I've always loved my original. I got injured on duty with the police and I had to retire early, which. It, on the positive side, led into me starting to write something I wanted to do for years. But had I not been injured, I probably wouldn't have started writing in the way I have done, because my original original plans were to become a university lecturer, and I'd started to write my applications for it, to teach, because I've always enjoyed teaching in various aspects within the military and the police. And when I saw what astronaut.com had to offer, I thought, I just made an offer to them. You know, would you like a regular contribution that teaches a little bit about astronomy, and if so, in what context? You know, for adults, for children. And as you see, that one's for like what I contribute there is just letting teenage it's aimed at teenagers, although it's for everyone. It just helps them learn more about the solar system we live in. I keep it to the solar system at the moment, although I'd love to take it onto my pet. black holes, quantum mechanics, and goodness me! But there you go. But yeah, it's like learning more about the place we live, because sometimes you've got to get good foundation. So the foundation for us is the solar system. So it's learning more about the solar system, the place we live, because it's a place of mystery and a place of incredible wonder. That what's just on our doorstep, cosmically speaking, is incredible, and sadly. It's missed out so much nowadays with computer games and things like that. Get a telescope, get a pair of binoculars if you can't afford a telescope, and just start looking up into the night sky. It's wonderful what's out there.
And it's not like there's not a lot of things up there.
Oh, very true, very true.
There's a couple of stars, a planet and a moon, and maybe a comet or two.
It is. Well, at the moment we've got a conjunction, haven't we, between, I don't know whether you're aware, there's because of the way the planets orbit, there's a conjunction between Jupiter and Mars, and people think, well, yeah, but after the moon, Venus. Venus is the second brightest object in the night sky, and Jupiter, despite the fact it's like half a billion miles away, that's the third brightest object in the sky, and it looks like, if you're looking at it from, our perspective on Earth, it looks like, you can see I'm quite animated about astronomy.
That's why I'm letting you keep going on it.
Do you know, I'm still on my first breath. Sorry about that. You can see it looks as if the two planets are going to collide, and they will at the end of the month, with, as it were, a crescent moon in the middle. Oh, goodness me. But it is. It's fascinating, because when you look at this, it just helps you appreciate just how tiny we are. And being, the science, bringing it back to science fiction and fantasy, if you like, even... Goodness me, come on, look, the further we look, the more we look, the more that we're finding out there. Do you think we're alone?
Well, I don't. The science and the science fiction has to go hand in hand. I mean, look at Jules Verne. Jules Verne was predicting cell phones, satellites, faxes, submarines before they were even possible for his technology level.
Yes, yeah, awesome, awesome writing.
And Star Trek now is projecting all the matter transmission, phasers, interstellar communicators and stuff. Like, well, we can start thinking that.
Yeah, they've already started developing that, haven't they? They've started to transport what they call quantum packets, for teleportation. It's incredible. And we're on the verge of an incredible explosion in technology. And, I sometimes feel like, oh, goodness me, if only I could be born in 100 years' time, that's where I belong. It's kind of, damn.
Yeah, well, and also knowing human nature, it's like we're either going to be super duper cool or, okay, where did the zombies come from? Oh, right there.
Yeah, now is the, what was it, the nuclear wind of our distant.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
those damn dirty apes,
and the whole fear about the Hadron Collider or whatever, and it's like, yeah, well, we didn't blow up the planet yet, right?
Yeah, we're working on it.
We're getting close. So I'm assuming that in through this whole point, you know nothing about horror.
I do enjoy horror, but how can I say? My lifestyle, it's funny how your lifestyle influences, not a lot scares me. don't get me wrong. When I was doing what I used to do in something, any fool who goes into battle who isn't frightened, is a liar, because you get scared, but you tend to face your fears. And with horror, I think there's got to be, how can I say, that element that makes you jump, and things like this. And I find a lot of horror boring. There is very, very few horror stories that make me get, you know, that little shiver down the spine. So, yeah, really sorry about that.
No worries. I mean, I agree to a degree, because I think there's always two kinds of horror. There's the horror that's like, okay, goes for the sharp and shiny, goes, hey, shock, hey, shock, hey, shock. And then there's the kind that just builds up to the, oh, my God, I can't believe that that was the end of the story kind of thing.
I'm just trying to think, because like a colleague at work of mine, you know, he's into horror. And, you know, oh, yeah, no, this is really scary. And it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of, yeah, okay. I'm just trying to think of something that made me think.
Well, okay, I'm going to throw something out at you. Have you ever heard of a movie called La Horde? It's La Horde. English, The Horde, but it's a French zombie movie. I find that a lot of the better, well-done, thoughtful horror stuff comes from not in the States or whatever, or is done by independent, small organizations. You get a difference between humorous and then just really psychotically, oh my God, that I could see that. La Horde is one of those types of zombie movies. You've got the whole zombie thing, everything's going slaughter, 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 but you have like very little development as to why the story started. You have a small military group went to try and find somebody, then they lost, and then, hey, the breakout and everything. But it builds on a solid base of action, and then towards the, okay, that's the end of the world sort of thing. And there's a lot of movies out there like that, but they don't get as much play as... another one you might like is called Dog Soldiers. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's a British one.
I've heard of Dog Soldiers, but again, because of... It's subject matter. I've steered away. I mean, there's very few of that. I mean, I love The Walking Dead. Don't get me wrong. I do love The Walking Dead. I mean, cool. You
know,
an entity that's becoming. You know, it's absolutely superb. I do. But no, I've heard of Dutch Soldiers, but it's something I steered away from, naturally. Unfortunately.
It was good in that what happens is that they don't present you the werewolves. It's a werewolf story. But they don't present you the werewolves and don't hit you over the head with it. It's like they kind of hint at it all throughout the movie, and then you only get one or two scenes at the end where they have the full-on werewolves at.
Yeah, I do like ones that are different. I must admit, like for touching on what we're talking about today, like with writing, I would tend to stand or steer away from vampire things because I think it's a very overdone theme. But there are some very good like vampire films out there, like Let Me In. That was quite different. I thought very different from, you say, your Blade, from your Underworld, from your Vampire Diaries.
Both of them, actually.
Yeah. I mean, it was superb. I loved it. Talking about Le Horde, like the French sometimes do come up with classics, don't they? I mean, I much preferred, although it's going off genre a little bit, Nikita.
Awesome movie, yeah.
As opposed to Assassin, I loved their original concept of it. But it's funny that The Walking Dead is slightly different. Again, in the way it's done, you know, it brings it much. You know, there's that element to it that, you know, I enjoy, as opposed to many of the other zombie things out there. It's just like,
The Walking Dead is not a zombie story; it's a people story with zombies.
And
that's why it really works. Because the zombies are just part of the background. They're not the actual story. It's the people.
Good.
And that's why I think when any good story is really good, it's about the story. It's about the development of people throughout that story, you know?
Yes.
And that's why Walking Dead works.
Yes, it is. I do enjoy it. It's funny you say that, and how tastes differ, because sometimes I've chatted about it with other people who've watched it. Oh, that was a boring one. I said, well, no, it wasn't. It's about, you know, yeah, that was about so-and-so, Rick that time, or so-and-so, and it showed, you know, something that's happened to their life, how they're developing now, how they've changed, become who they are.
Totally, because I also get every once in a while, some people say, oh, that book was boring. It's like, what are you talking about? It was science fiction. Science fiction can tend generally to be very boring if you're expecting pop, 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 pop.
Yeah, very true.
You know, it's like some people just have an expectation where they want... Doctor Who, for example. Do you remember the old Doctor Who series?
Oh, goodness me, yes. I've fallen away from it a little bit because it's difficult to get over here, but I followed Doctor Who from the beginning. You know, I have certain favourites who I thought were very good Doctor Whos. Others who I didn't like at all, but yes, I followed Doctor Who from the beginning.
I'm a Pertwee guy. That's who got me on Doctor Who, and then I would backtrack to all the originals as well.
Growing up, John Pertwee was one of the best Doctors ever.
I agree.
Just the right blend, if you like, of maturity, of action, and scientific know-how. Yeah, John Pertwee was an absolutely superb Doctor. I mean, the first Tom Baker was quite good because he was eccentric enough to carry it. He was just out there. But the second Tom Baker, I didn't like him so much. I sorry to Tom Baker if you're listening, but the second one, that is. But I didn't like him at all. Tennant, I thought, was an excellent Doctor. I like Tennant. This is a shame that they commit to something and then don't commit to it. They take it away. John Pertwee was Doctor Who for many years, and he did an excellent job. Yeah. Yeah.
And what I was going with that was that the original series is, they were long episodes. I mean, you had a story arc of six-ish episodes that carried that one story.
Yes.
Then we have the more recent incarnation, which has been officially proclaimed as being more U.S. friend or American friendly for audiences there, where it's individual episodes. And that's a big change.
I think it loses it. I do, and I don't know. Do you know? I don't know whether it sometimes links into sometimes why the series doesn't get that second run. My wife and I were just getting into a new series, and it was totally nothing to do with science fiction or fantasy. Those Who Kill. We had it just on TV here, but very deep, very psychological cop drama, and so we really enjoyed it. But that story arc, it continued. You know, it continued episode after episode after episode. And like you say, it seems nowadays, if it's not like an instant fix, people the powers that be, sometimes it could be the audience, you know, they don't seem to relate to it. And it's such a shame because you've got to have that background development, you know, to bring out the full flavor, I think. You know, I think it's lacking when you have these short one episode. Everything happens in one of it. Well, life's not like that.
Like Star Trek Next Generation.
Well, yeah. I was just thinking of another, like that space opera, Babylon 5.
Babylon 5.
Well, look at the story arc of that.
Yes.
And how it had to develop over such an... I mean, when they started, like Star Trek Next Generation, it was wooden. When it first started, they were a bit wooden, weren't
yes.
they? When, you know, but God, when you stuck with it, they developed, and you got to know each of the characters, and there was this background story that gradually, you know, and you know, it's almost like they've been speaking to Stephen Dalton, you know, and it was like, and it's not until the last thing you think, oh my goodness, look at all this coming together, and you think it's vast. It's wonderful.
Yeah, Babylon 5 was one of those shows. It's like, okay, so it's a little corny now if you watch it now, but back then it was like, dudes, this is a series that's got a 10,000-year history prior, a 10,000 history post, and then you've got the show, and he's got most of the show mapped out for a five-year course.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's awesome, and it's such a shame that they did a follow-on to that, didn't they? We're talking about like the follow-on.
Crusade,
you know, I thought, oh, that had potential. Especially with the who were they? The Necromancer. Edward Woodward's son.
Yes. I know who you're talking about. The bald guy who was the mage.
Yeah, that's it.
Technomage. Technomage. Yeah.
And you know, you think, oh come on, there's such a lot you could do with this, and no, you know, you think, oh idiots.
Did you know that the ship designed for that show, Crusade, was actually designed by JPL?
Really?
Yep. It was one of those things where the show reached out to NASA and said, hey, we're creating a new series. We want you to give us some ideas on what a ship would like for doing deep space exploration. And they presented them that. And it's like, yep, that works.
There you go.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep. I'm a big fan of everything. And one of the great things about Babylon 5 was the music. The guy who did the scores to the music basically did a full-on symphonic-type score for each episode.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Like I said, I'm a big fan. I follow stuff. But then I also pick up lots of useless information because I'm kooky that way.
Yeah.
But we're pretty much at the end of the show right now. So it's like throw out the ways how people can follow, stalk, find you, do stuff, all that other stuff.
goodness me, I've even forgot my own website. So if you go to, like, if you just put my name in, Andrew P. Weston, and www thing, you can find my website. From the website, you can go to the blog, to a Facebook page, to the author page. They're all interlinked. If you're that bored that you need something to kill 5 minutes with, start taking a look. You might be intrigued. I know I am, but there you go.
Facebook, Twitter, yeah, Instagram.
Yeah, I'm on those. They're all LinkedIn. Once you start to go into the various pages, they're all linked. It's all listed there. It's all boring. But, you know, there's some entertainment to be found in there.
Well, Andrew, thank you very much for coming on the show. I appreciate it tremendously. It's been a pant load of fun talking about this sort of stuff.
Ah, thank you. It's been great. You know, I like it when it's totally unrehearsed.
Wait, you know, you didn't get the script on this? Okay.
Ah, darn. No, it was in Chinese. I haven't read that. I haven't weighed that off yet.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, all righty. And everybody out now after Outline, thank you for coming by out, listening to the show on the streams, on the live show, on and in the recorded archives. Thanks a bunch. Everybody, have fun and be happy.
Of a big surprise. If you go down in the woods today, you'd better go in disguise. For every bear that ever there was will gather there for certain, because today's the day that teddy bears have their picnic.